KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW.com. My guest, writer, director Nicholas Stoller, has a way of making romance the center of everything he's done, an ideal romance. I think it even for me goes back to his work on Undeclared, where I'm guessing he first met Jason Segel. His newest film as writer director, I guess co-writer, is 5-Year Engagement. Before that, we know him from Get Him to the Greek and his first collaboration with Jason Segel, which was, of course, Forgetting Sarah Marshall. Nick, first of all, thanks so much for being here.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
And talk about that, about how much romance means to you. I mean, because you've done these things really about people pursuing an ideal of romance.
Well, the romantic comedy genre is my favorite genre. It's, to me, the most satisfying movie-going experience I have, personally, is, you know, seeing a great romantic comedy.
What is it about romantic comedy that really plays so well for you?
Well, great romantic comedy makes you laugh really hard, and you see yourself in the characters, and then there's just the Shakespearean wish fulfillment at the end of seeing a couple that you're rooting for get together. It just makes me feel good when I see a great romantic comedy in a way that, to me at least, no other genre really hits.
Because for me, what you do is this kind of intersection of screwball comedy where people sort of get themselves in trouble by trying to explain themselves. And also this thing of sort of like 70s, the great 70s movies, which feel like they're anecdotal, but really lead us to a point. Was that a fair assessment to me?
Yes, thank you. I'm very honored that you see them that way. But yeah, I think for me, the characters get themselves in enough trouble. A lot of romantic comedies that aren't firing on all cylinders, I think, rely on miscommunication as a plot device. Like, the girl sees the guy like hugging his ex-girlfriend and doesn't, you know, nothing's actually happening, but she gets mad and that, you know. And I'm not as interested in that. I think it's much funnier to see characters that are, you know, flawed like all of us, trying to do the right thing and then failing.
Yeah, I mean, it's this thing where you get these people too who are really incredibly almost hyper-articulate about themselves and sort of explaining way too much about themselves.
Oh yeah, they're neurotic overthinkers in the great tradition of romantic comedy. Neurotic overthinkers, from Annie Hall to When Harry Met Sally to Broadcast News.
Yeah, it feels to me like it's as you say, this a particularly kind of American thing, and your interest in comedy goes back a long way, doesn't it?
Yeah, in terms of stuff I've watched and love, yeah, I mean, I love, you know, everything from His Girl Friday to The Apartment to, you know, more recent stuff like Broadcast News, not that, you know.
You bring up His Girl Friday, and that kind of constant talk, and people almost talking over each other, is also a big element in the films you've made so far.
Yeah, I think there's nothing funnier than someone who is very intelligent, hyper-articulate, overthinking everything. I think that can lead to really funny stuff, and the audience then sees themselves in that character, because you don't want to present a character to the audience that's not intelligent, that's, you know, they don't see themselves as this, because everyone obviously thinks of themselves as intelligent. So
yeah, it's interesting too, because you talked about the way a lot of conventional romantic comedies operate, and they set up these false obstacles, like some, like you said, a girl seeing her boyfriend hug an ex, and the sort of thing that somebody's in a relationship really wouldn't trigger those kinds of things in real life.
In a normal relationship, if that happened and you had a good relationship, the guy would go and be like, I was just hugging my ex because her like cat fell out of the tree or whatever it is, you know, and that just would be immediately resolved. And I think it's much funnier to kind of, you know, like in When Harry Met Sally, like there's that amazing moment where, you know, the classic moment where Meg Ryan and Billy Crystal have hooked up for the first time, and you just pull up and she's just hopelessly in love. You can see her like nuzzling into him, and he's just staring up into, you know, into space, like terrified. And so the audience immediately hooks into that in a great way.
It's The Treatment, which you can hear at KCRW.com. My guest is writer-director Nick Stoller, whose new film is the completely explanatory title, The 5-Year Engagement. As we did an event recently at Lackman, I said, that's an incredibly brave thing to basically say, this is the movie.
Yeah. This is the movie. You know, I've done two movies which have, now people know what they are, but no one knew who Sarah Marshall was when we were doing Forgetting Sarah Marshall. And Get Him to the Greek, people thought it was a frat house comedy. And so I really wanted to do a movie which the title is the movie. It's the Snakes on a Plane theory. theory of titling your movie.
Okay, well, let's just carry this out to its illogical conclusion. With snakes on a plane, you're going to see the snakes on the plane.
Right, exactly.
And 5-year engagement, if it's a comedy, well, you're thinking, well, 5-year engagement, well, what do you do with that?
Right. Well, I think what it captures, what the title captures, and certainly what we were going for, is there just everyone knows that couple or was that couple at some point. I've certainly found that couple fascinating and, you know, why a couple that's dated forever can't pull the trigger, whether they've dated or been engaged forever. And so that's kind of what that title encapsulates.
Talk about that couple and tell us about those leads played by Jason Segel, with whom you worked on the script, and Emily Blunt.
Well, you know, Jason plays a character named Tom Solomon, who's a chef. He's rising up through the ranks. He wants to be like a 3-star chef in a fancy San Francisco restaurant. And Emily Blunt plays a character named Violet. She's a social psychology grad student who wants to be a professor one day. And they have kind of, you know, Jason Segel and I, who wrote the script with, had this idea of best laid plans. They both love each other. They both want the best for each other. But they're innocents and they're naive about their relationship and their prospects. And so she gets a job offer at Michigan – U of M, and they have to move, and Jason thinks it's going to be fine, but there are no fancy restaurants. There's a lot of great food in Ann Arbor, but it's as you're well aware of, but there isn't the kind of 4-star cuisine, you know, fancy cuisine that like San Francisco or, you know, kind of bigger cities has. It's more of a college town. So it's a movie about compromising and about that question of, is this relationship perfect enough? How perfect does a relationship need to be to commit?
Well, one of the things I find fascinating about the films you've done is how being pulled away from home really disorients people. Mm-hmm. I mean, Jason's character in Forgetting Sarah Marshall is taken out of his home and in this sort of lush paradise and doesn't know what to do with himself. And Jonah Hill in Get Him to the Greek, his home was kind of falling apart around him.
Yeah.
And here they're both taken away from their homes. And taking people out of a place where they feel comfortable and putting them in a new setting is really a strong component of the way you write.
Yeah, I think being taken out of your home, it's disorienting, you know, and you feel completely untethered, you know, and you have to make new friends, and you have to, and your identity too, especially if you're trying to find a new job, you start to lose your identity. And it certainly seemed interesting to us to kind of play with the paradynamics in the relationship. And so a big thing is they're leaving their home. They're leaving San Francisco. That's kind of almost more, because Jason is happy from an employed perspective there, that's kind of more his home.
He's also a star there.
And he's a star there. And whereas Emily's character is a little bit more kind of like waiting to find, you know, waiting for her career to take off. And so when they move to Michigan, she really clicks immediately with it. She's surrounded by like-minded people who are other social psychology grad students. She kind of becomes the star, and the dynamic shifts. Jason works at a wonderful, awesome restaurant called the Zingerman's Deli, but it's not what he perceived as, it's not what he thought he'd be doing. He thought he'd be, you know, working more in kind of fancier restaurants.
Fine dining.
Yeah, fine dining, exactly. And so he becomes, you know, as Chris Pratt's character, Chris Pratt plays his best friend who remains in San Francisco and becomes the star chef that he always wished he could have become. And he says to him at a certain moment, the tether's cut. You're in orbit. And it's like, it's an apt description of what happens when you leave home.
It's The Treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW.com. We're talking about the awesomely titled film, The 5-Year Engagement.
What's it about?
I give up. What is it about? It's writer-director Nick Stoller is here. But talk to me about coming to L.A. for the first time. Do you feel that sense of disorientation? Because it's obviously something that you're enormously comfortable writing about. Mm-hmm. Did you feel that when you first came here?
You know, I grew up in Miami, which is at least in terms of the physical layout, quite similar to L.A. So I just,
is it? Okay.
Yeah. I remember, you know, I lived in New York for a year after college, like everyone, like a lot of people.
What did you do in New York when you were there?
I was in advertising.
What was that like?
It was, you know, I loved it. It was, I mean, it wasn't exactly what I wanted to do, but I met really interesting people, and it was a good training ground to teach you to write about things you don't want to write about. So it was a good way to, like, learn about how to, like, how to deal with writer's block. You know, they would present me with, like, at the time, Ericsson cell phones existed, and they present me with an Ericsson cell phone, and they write about it, and I would have to come up with a bunch of stuff by the end of the day. And it was a really, it's a tool that I've used to, you know, in screenwriting. You know, you don't want to write every day, and you have to. So,
in a case like that, when something you don't want to do, how do you judge your efforts? If it's something that's just basically like solving a math problem,
mm-hmm. You know, you kind of, at least for me, with writing, when you're in learning to kind of force yourself to write about something, you're kind of hitting your head against the wall, but you have to keep hitting your head against the wall. And then suddenly you break through it and you start to come up with a bunch of different, in that case, Ericsson cell phone taglines. You start to come up with a bunch of stuff, and then you get invested in what, in your work, you know, whether you were at the beginning, you get invested in it, and you start, and you can judge it based on that. So,
I know when we met, you told me you were at the Harvard Lampoon, mm-hmm. and that as a medium exists as a way to comment on what's going on in the culture. Were you able to use that, those skills that you had from that in working in advertising?
Yeah, I definitely, you know, I definitely was. My stuff certainly, like, was way more comedic, I would say, in tone. You know, some people are really good at kind of capturing more dramatic ads or whatever. My stuff definitely leaned more towards the comedic side of stuff. And, it, you know, I'll say the other thing about advertising was it's a really good way to capture a voice in a really brief amount of time. I worked on a lot of beer campaigns. Again, I worked for years, so it wasn't like I was there for forever. But the guys that I worked with taught me a lot about capturing voice, because they did these Miller beer spots that had a very particular voice, and you have 30 seconds to do it and to introduce the audience to this voice. And so that was something too that, like, that I learned quickly, to not just write kind of a bland narration, but to, like, hit a voice hard.
What was that voice in those ads? What were you trying to get at?
The voice of the ads that I worked on was kind of a manly kind of Boston voice.
I'm sure you knew that voice very well.
Yeah, exactly. I knew the voice from college.
Those voices that you're talking about, those voices become very clear very fast.
Mm-hmm. They have to be, you know.
Yeah, and your work as a screenwriter as well. And I'm guessing having to make voices materialize very quickly really helped you a lot on Undeclared, did it not?
Yeah, and it also helped in terms of writing, because Undeclared was Judd's voice, obviously, and those characters.
What you say is it was Conrad and about 5 or 6 years ago.
No, longer. It was
2001. Yeah, 2000. Just after Freaks and Geeks.
Yeah, so after, yeah.
Basically sort of the follow-up, it was set at the first year of college.
Yeah.
But it was a show where those voices, those characters, were defined basically by the second or third episode.
Yeah, they were defined quickly. And something that, you know, I certainly learned from Judd Apatow, who created that, and was to write for the actors and to rewrite for the particular voice of those actors.
Which is unusual, because usually you're trying to force a character on an actor. Mm-hmm. That's what sitcoms generally do, yeah, rather than finding the actor's voice and playing to that.
Yeah, and I think it makes, you know, it's what we've done in all our movies, and it's what we, you know, what we did on Undeclared. And it's, I mean, it started, I'm sure it started before that with, you know, I think Judd talks about Larry Sanders and stuff, it's starting there. But when you rewrite for the actor's natural voice, it just becomes way funnier, and the whole character becomes stronger. And like on 5 Year Engagement, Jason, you know, Jason's character was written in his voice because Jason was writing the script with me. But then we sat down with Emily for a number of work sessions and made sure it was totally in her voice. And then once we've cast the rest of the movie, we rewrote every character into everyone's voice, you know, which is why those characters are pop and are visceral, because we're pretty lazy. We're just writing it for the people we've cast.
Well, isn't though casting really the key to it anyway? Once you get the actors, then you know what you've got.
Yeah, it's with comedy at least. I can't speak to other genres. It's the script and the cast, and that's it.
Yeah. Well, great place to take a break. We'll take a break. My guest is Nicholas Stoller. His new film as writer-director is The 5 Year Engagement. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Welcome back. We're talking about the mysteriously titled The 5-Year Engagement.
I don't understand. Start over.
People used to not understanding the show. It's The Treatment, which you can hear at KCRW.com. I'm speaking with its writer director, Nicholas Stoller. We were talking about voices before and writing for actors. And I remember a story you telling me we were having drinks a couple of years ago about how or what the Russell Brand character wasn't initially in Forgetting Sarah Marshall. He wasn't that guy. He was basically the guy Reese Fahn plays in The 5-Year Engagement, wasn't he?
Yeah. Well, he was I guess that's true. He was similar to that. He was originally a very good-looking English writer. He was very sure of himself and kind person, and you know, but he was a writer, I think. And as soon as Russell walked in and auditioned, we were like, first, he's got the part. He's amazing. He's brilliant. And then we knew immediately we had to rewrite it to fit his persona. And he just seems like a rock star. And so it completely changed the entire character to that. And it made it way stronger and, you know, way funnier. And whoever we had cast, if Russell hadn't walked in, which would have been bad for the movie, but if he hadn't, we would have rewritten it. We would have rewritten it for whoever that person was, you know. But he came in and just that immediately spoke to us.
And there's this thing, too, that it's kind of easy for me to see in the work, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, which basically everybody in the show does. There's a kind of narcissism sometimes. These people are so invested in themselves that becomes part of the comedy, too, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it is self-interest, is selfishness, I think, when you come down to it. I mean, with love, a big thing about love is learning to not be selfish. Like, it's just, you know, if you're... and so certainly in 5-Year Engagement, like both characters, both Jason and Emily are being pretty they're kind of being selfish. You know, Jason wants the job that he wants. Emily wants the job that she wants. And that's totally fair. But if you want a strong relationship, which ultimately I personally believe is the most important ingredient to happiness, that you have to compromise and, you know, in certain ways.
I guess one of the things I wanted to ask you about, too, and that seems to be kind of important, is the modern definition of masculinity and guys sort of being emasculated.
I'm the wrong guy to ask.
Let's just say for the sake of argument, you were such a guy.
Yeah.
but there are always questions of masculinity being asked in these movies.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, certainly with Sarah Marshall, our big go-to image was Jason holds the purse. And that's emasculating, that he holds the purse. The reveal in that movie is like, it starts with he's blaming Sarah Marshall, he's blaming her. And then it turns out he's been kind of a bad, depressed guy because he's allowed himself to be emasculated. And it's made him not a strong partner for Sarah. And certainly in 5-Year Engagement, Jason kind of, he starts off as the man, you know, he has a great job and stuff. And then they move to Michigan and then he's not happy. And rather than talking about that with his fiancée, with Emily, he becomes self-loathing and kind of tries to be passive-aggressive and gets really weird. And, you know, she's at fault, too. She ignores it and kind of pretends everything's fine, you know, versus hashing it out.
We're debating questions of masculinity with Nicholas Stoller, who's the film writer director, is The 5-Year Engagement. It's The Treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW.com. Talking about the movie, I don't want to give too much away, but that point where he becomes weird is, and I mentioned this to you, I think a big dramatic beat, because when that happens, and when I saw the movie, people just start whispering about it, and they just stop laughing. Oh my God. It becomes that moment where I was talking to you about this before, when you see a couple that's been together for a long time, you can see them falling up, breaking apart, because there are these passive aggressive ways that the person who's lost power starts to act out.
Yeah, it's sad, but also fascinating to watch a couple implode. I can't say that this doesn't speak well of me, but in my experience, when I've watched friends of mine, their relationships implode, I feel bad for them, but I'm also kind of like mentally taking notes and watching it happen.
Do you do that? Do you find yourself just watching people sometimes and then watching these situations that they live through thinking, there's a movie in this somewhere?
Not like in terms of specific details, but I find relationships, whether they're good or in free fall or whatever, fascinating and want to talk about it and get to the bottom of it and get to the truth of it. That's interesting to me.
See, that's the thing that I think is sort of key in these films, that each person in the film has a different definition of what truth is. And they're kind of clinging to these definitions and trying to sort of get the other person to see what it is they believe to be the truth. I mean, you can see it in Get Him to the Greek, where Russell is completely self-immolating and so self-involved he can't get past seeing that. And Jonah's trying to get him to see, well, no, that's not what this is at all. And that's that happens in Sarah Marshall, too, where they both have incredibly different ideas of the truth. Mm-hmm. And certainly happens in the five-year engagement as well. It's almost like this kind of sort of comedic version of Rashomon.
Yeah, it's true. Like you, like, and I think that's true in relationships that you people, especially if you're not communicating, which I think is a big problem in relationships that are in free fall, you start to really live in your own head and you start to develop your own universe and your own sense of the truth, which then explodes in some way.
Well, I just find it to be fascinating because generally in these romantic comedies, there's the truth that, you know, that is kind of objective.
Yeah.
And then we're kind of watching people not arrive at that truth. But there is no sort of fast-held objective truth in these movies that you work on. I mean, there's not one thing that's true for everybody.
Yeah. I mean, what I love is when we screened Five-Year Engagement, there's this fight in the middle. Basically, he finds out that she's going to be extended. Her postdoc, her job has been extended for another year. And she wants to stay, and he wants to move back to San Francisco. And he hasn't been honest about his feelings until now. And there's a line where she goes, why don't you talk about these things? And he says, because I'm a guy, and men don't talk about these things. A guy two rows behind me when we screened it went, amen, brother. Like, just yell that out. And then when she was yelling, when Emily was yelling at Jason, I heard women laughing at what she was saying and supporting what she was saying. And so there is this kind of like, both people are right and both people are wrong. And that's the debate, you know, we want to start at the end of this movie, you know, ideally, that people walk out. Hopefully it won't cause people to break up, but people will walk out and chat about it and be like, I thought she was right. I thought she was wrong.
See, I think that's funny too, just because, again, you're talking about making these things about, there's not some big inciting incident that you're taught to hew to in these screenwriting classes and these books that say there's got to be that thing. And the funny thing, too, is that he talks all the time. For him to say he doesn't talk is completely self-delusional.
Yeah, he talks all the time, but he never expresses his feelings really in an honest way until the middle, until they have that kind of blow up. He either is innocent, so he says to her when they decide to move, he's like, it'll be fine, let's move to Michigan, which he honestly believes, but he's wrong. He doesn't know that he's wrong. And actually, there's a line in there that's telling where he goes, you're going to resent me. And he says, I'd rather be the resentor than the resented. And that's like the key to like martyr complex and passive aggression, which he doesn't know. He legitimately believes that it'll be fine in Michigan. But then when it isn't, he never talks about it. And we just talked about this the other day, last night. But when I watch like My Touchstones, or as I said, or Annie Hall and Broadcast News, When Harry Met Sally, which all have a similarly kind of feel wandering, but aren't when you watch them. You're not bored. You're super engaged. And when I watch those, I watched those before we started writing 5 Year and graphed out, you know, the moments in those movies, and they're really tightly plotted. Like When Harry Met Sally, in every single scene, they're repeating the thesis of the film, which is, can a man and a woman be friends? They're repeating that in various ways. And we do that in 5 Year in a kind of a subtle way where you're not noticing it subconsciously, but subconsciously you're super engaged in the story that on the surface at least feels like it's wandering around.
We're talking about wandering with the writing director of 5 Year Engagement, Nicholas Stoller's The Treatment. You can also hear the show at kcrw.com. But that's the thing I was saying to you. The movies all feel like they're anecdotal, mm-hmm. you know, just one story after another, that because the movies are all plotted. And almost these kind of strict kind of timelines. I mean, you state the timeline in the 5 Year Engagement, but there's a time imperative. Okay, I just can't stop talking about that. There's sort of a time imperative in Get Him to the Greek and in Forgetting Sarah Marshall as well. He goes away, but he can only stay at this place so long because he's starting to run out of money.
Yeah.
So, I mean, time becomes an issue in all these things for you too, does it not?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Get Him to the Greek, there was a Jonah and I had a joke about, I would say to him, okay, it's time to film you looking at your watch again. Like that was the tightest timeline ever. I think it was, and we had like that,
flashing a clock.
Yeah, a literal ticking clock. We literally would show the clock 72 hours to the Greek, you know, 48 hours to the Greek. But 5 years, you know, we obviously have a time when the audience knows they're going to experience 5 years. But what's interesting about it, the challenge is to be like, well, you don't know how this time is going to be spent.
I think that's these things all, again, to people watching and maybe not paying that close attention, they feel incidental, but they're very specific things because time is so important to you in the way you structure things. And I wonder where that comes from for you, because it's so specific to the way you've worked in these three films.
Yeah, I mean, I think that a strong sense of time benefits any film. You know, I think that it's the writers hate hearing, like, what's the ticking clock? But, like, you'd rather it's, like, you know, whether it's, like, literally a ticking clock, like in Greek, or there's something kind of, like, in 5 years, you get this sense that they really need to figure this out, that it's something that engages the viewer, you know. And there's also a strong sense of time. You can track more easily where the characters are, you know. I mean, we talked about Annie Hall, where at the beginning of the movie you see Woody Allen with Annie Hall, and she's singing, and, you know, people are throwing stuff at her and not listening and talking to each other. And then later you see the same, you know, it's years later, and you see her singing, and she's now successful. And
she's incredibly confident, and yeah. She owns it, and that's also the point where you know this is over.
Yeah, you know it's over. And they do it again in When Harry Met Sally. You see them buy a Christmas tree together, and then you see them broken up, and you see her buy a Christmas tree alone. And it's really simple, but it's visceral. I think that a strong sense of time just helps, you know, bolster your movie.
It's funny, as you're talking about these things, you're talking about what for audiences are classic moments. Mm-hmm. Do you feel that you're working to create things like that, or does it feel, because what you're talking about is manufacturing these touchstones that will become moments like that, mm-hmm. aren't you?
Well, I mean, I certainly hope that, but, you know, we go at it with, like, what's going to tell the best story, and that's really the only way to approach it. I try not to think about how will this be received, or what does that mean, or what does this mean, you know. It's very much an approach of just, like, how is this story going to be told the best? Like, how are we best going to tell the story? And then hopefully something really, you know, jives with the audience once it's out. But I don't really think about if it's going to be classic. I mean, I think the movie's going to be totally classic. Obviously.
It wasn't me who said that.
Yeah, but, I mean.
But I just find these two poles to be really fascinating, where there is that sort of clock that we're aware of in these movies as audiences, but also, again, that sort of sense of people not being at home. So it's mm-hmm. like, they're two really very different things, but also things that help to apply a kind of pressure again. So there aren't these kinds of weird sort of almost contrived moments that we feel these people have to get over. But they feel like sort of central to making these things feel real rather than sitcom-y. And the maybe the reason you're writing these as movies rather than TV shows.
Yeah, I mean, I think, like, with the moves of 5 Year, we tried to just really make it as natural as possible. To make it all character driven. And so when she, at the beginning, she's like, I'm going to move, do you want to move to Michigan, to Jason? And he's like, well, how long, she's freaking out because she doesn't want to upset him. And he says, well, how long is the thing? And she's like, 2 years. And he's like, 2 years is nothing. We'll be fine. Turns out 2 years isn't nothing. It's a long period of time. At the end of the, you see him trying to put on a brave face for those 2 years. And then he finds out that her job could be extended for an additional 2 years and potentially forever. The time demarcations are very clear. So the audience knows exactly where they are in the story and what's happening, you know.
And with that, we're out of time. Nick, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you very much for having me.
My guest is writer-director Nicholas Stoller. His new film as writer-director is The 5 Year Engagement. I just really like saying that. Our recording engineer, KCRW in Santa Monica, is J.C. Swanick, who also mixes the show. It's edited by producer Jenny Radulet. This show works in terms of 5 Year Engagement. So on my fourth, I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
Find past episodes of The Treatment at kcrw.com or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Listen to The Treatment on demand on your smartphone with KCRW's apps. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.